This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, deep roasting and blending coffee beans since 1966. Pete's.com or 800-999-2132.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos-Tierre has more.
I'm Alicia Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the U.S. Department of Justice asks that the Hanford Waste Initiative passed by Washington state voters be declared unconstitutional and overturned. President Bush will promote a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. The U.S. military orders commanders to hold ethics trainings today in response to increasing outrage over reports that U.S. Marines killed 24 unarmed civilians in the western Iraqi town of Haditha last year.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,471 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 42,444 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate the true Iraq body count may be as high as 250,000 dead. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 1st, 2006. I'm Tom Knipp.
Hi, Tom. And I'm Marlise Franklin. Oregon taxpayers could get the biggest kicker income tax refunds ever next fall, but Governor Ted Kulongoski said he will urge the legislature to suspend the rebates and instead use the projected $883 million in the kicker fund to rebuild the state's education and health care systems and to invest in alternative fuels. Oregon is the only state with a kicker in its state tax rules. Under the rule which voters put into the state constitution in 2001, if a tax payment exceeds what state officials project when they enact the two-year state budget by at least 2%, all the unanticipated money is rebated to taxpayers. About $200 million of the kicker fund will go to corporations. Kulongoski said and the corporate tax rebates should be eliminated as well. He urges the legislature and voters to use unanticipated corporate tax payments to create a state rainy day fund rather than send the money back to corporations.
The U.S. Department of Justice asked Tuesday that the Hanford Waste Initiative, passed by Washington state voters, be declared unconstitutional and overturned. In 2004, voters in every county of the state but Benton and Franklin approved the initiative. It was intended to stop the Department of Energy from bringing more waste to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation until waste already there is cleaned up. But before it could become law as the Cleanup Priority Act, the Department of Justice filed suit. Congress has given the federal government the authority to manage nuclear materials because they are critical to national defense and security, but Washington State has been given authority by Congress to manage certain hazardous chemical wastes. U.S. District Judge Alan McDonald listened to arguments based on written briefs filed over the last 7 months, then said he would rule on the motion for summary judgment in 2 to 3 weeks.
A bicyclist was struck and killed yesterday by a loaded log truck west of Cottage Grove. Authorities identified the victim as 47-year-old Jane Higdon of Eugene. Police said a group of four bicyclists were riding along Territorial Road near Ham Road when one of the cyclists crashed. Higdon moved to the southbound lane to avoid the other cyclists. At the same time, a southbound truck loaded with logs was approaching. The log truck moved toward the northbound lane in an attempt to avoid Higdon, but the right side of the truck struck her. After impact, the log truck driver stopped, and the highway was closed for nearly 4 hours for the investigation. Higdon was pronounced dead at the scene.
500,000 students quit high school each year. An estimated 25 to 30% of students who enter high school in the United States do not earn a diploma. This weekend, educational researcher Brent Cameron speaks in and Beaverton about what he calls the self-design approach to education. KBOO caught up with Cameron today and recorded his thoughts on what's wrong and how to fix it.
Well, you know, we've invested all our energy in education into schooling, and schooling is a model that was invented a couple hundred years ago, and it hasn't changed, and it doesn't meet the new needs of children and youth in our society today because we're in an information society and we're no longer in the industrial age. And yet we've got no experiments in education outside of schooling. All the experts, all the psychologists, we have this one model that is all learning is all based on instruction and teaching. And so we don't know what else to do, and so all we do is when there's a problem, we blame the kids for not working hard enough or having learning problems, and then we increase the pressure to perform within the model, and we don't know what to do outside of that model. I pretty much accidentally discovered this, mostly as a parent and certainly not as an educator. From the birth of my daughter until she was six, I observed the most phenomenal learning demonstration that I'd ever seen, watching her learn how to talk. But I did an experiment, you know, based on my observations of natural learning, where these kids, out of their enthusiasm and their curiosity and their exploration and discovery of the world, which is, I think, what the human being is designed to do, they achieved levels of skill and ability and have now developed into, you know, well-rounded, happy, talented young people. I'd realized that I'd discovered something that nobody else was able to look at because everybody is looking through the window of schooling. We come together as a group of people to support learning, not just with our children, but in families and in communities, and how can we create a rich and exciting and meaningful learning program that really emerges out of the needs and interests and abilities that exist in the community. So we're here to discuss that and to share the successes we've had in Canada over the last 23 years and really imagine what could emerge in this initiative here in Portland. You know, when I hear that they're going to increase the focus on math and science and we've got to compete in the world and, you know, there's this sort of basis of fear and lack and need at the heart of those assumptions, what I'd like to bring forward is this idea of trust and respect and working with nature rather than against it, working with children and respecting their interests and their natural abilities, and to really question this incessant need of progress and science and you know, that the arts and human community and enjoyment are probably being overlooked, and you know, we need to really sit down and start conversations in communities and listen to the children and what they're interested in. And there's a wealth of wisdom in every child, and it's time to include them in the educational process.
That was educational researcher Brent Cameron. He'll hold an educational workshop June 2nd and June 3rd at the Village Home. Call 503-892-2458 or go to www.villagehome.org. Marlise?
Thanks, Tom. A public health advisory has been issued due to higher than normal levels of bacteria in ocean waters at Silats Bay Beach in Lincoln City. Water samples indicate higher than normal levels of fecal bacteria, which can result in skin rashes, upper respiratory, and other illness. Direct contact with the water should be avoided until the advisory is lifted. This is especially true for children. The elderly may be more vulnerable to waterborne bacteria. While advisors in effect silence bade visitors should avoid wading in nearby creeks and stay clear of water runoff flowing into the ocean. Even if there is no advisory in effect, officials recommend avoiding swimming in the ocean within 48 hours after a rainstorm.
Oregon bars that allow smoking have dangerously high levels of air pollution, according to a new study from Oregon public health advocates and bar owners. KBOO's Jessica Rink Perry reports.
Air pollution in Oregon bars where smokers light up is three times higher than national safety standards. A new study from public health advocates and bar owners shows that indoor air pollution levels in bars that allow smoking is six times higher than in bars where smoking is prohibited. Tabithia Engel with the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon says those levels of pollution are harmful for customers and extremely toxic for workers.
Even 30 minutes of exposure is harmful. On average in Oregon, the air in bars that allow smoking and restaurants with bars have dangerously high levels of secondhand smoke, especially for the people who work there day in and day out.
Engel says they're hoping to use the study to lobby for a legislative policy against smoking in all public places. Oregon currently allows smoking in bars, bowling alleys, tobacco shops, and restaurants with bars. Washington and California have already passed complete smoke-free workplace laws.
Everyone deserves the right to breathe clean air, and we know that secondhand smoke is a serious health hazard, and we have a solution.
I'm Jessica Rink Perry, KBOO News.
Tonight on the Eugene Report, which came first, the chicken or the egg, goes the old saying. But the question the University of Oregon Students for the Ethical Treatment of Animal group asks is, why should the University of Oregon pay $50,000 each year to farmers that keep chickens in humane and unethical conditions instead of supporting farmers that keep chickens cage-free and healthy? Amy Pincus Merwin has the story.
This is Inform Radio, progressive news and community affairs from Eugene, Corvallis, and Southern Cascadia.
This is Amy Merwin. Students for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at the University of Oregon are asking the university to switch from purchasing $50,000 worth of caged chicken eggs to chickens that are allowed to be caged free. Here to tell us about this is Carrie Packwood Freeman, who's a doctoral student in mass communications at the University of Oregon and an organizer with CETA.
Our CETA group got this idea because I was getting emails from the Humane Society of the United States, and I was seeing this trend starting over the last year or two. We've got at least 80 universities across this nation that have switched from traditional egg agribusiness, which is battery cage hens, factory farming, to cage-free hens. And it just seems like University of Oregon would be the perfect kind of school to be one of the leaders in setting this trend.
Does the University of Oregon Food Services already provide a pretty wide variety, including organic and local?
I don't know how much of what they provide is organic and local. I know they try to provide some vegan and vegetarian dishes. This is mainly about where they're getting their food from. I think we need to be responsible about where we're getting the eggs, because if we're getting them from a place that we actually totally disagree with, then it's actually affecting our integrity. Looking at the amount of recycling that's on this campus and just the general student body and staff and how socially conscious we are and how we're nationally known for being that. So I want to see that reflected also in the food that we serve. I don't know that it is to a large enough degree.
Let's talk about the conditions that caged chickens are kept in.
The conditions on the battery cage farms are hellish and gross. The birds are crammed into cages, and they're in different tiers, so the cages are on top of each other. That means the excrement and the urine from the hens on the top flows down onto the hens beneath them. And they're supposed to clean out the manure pits at the bottom, but apparently it just smells completely toxic because of all the ammonia. These hens are caged their entire life to pump out eggs. If these conditions were in the middle of campus, nobody would stand for it if we actually had to see it and smell it.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly.
By comparison, chickens that are allowed to be cage-free, what are the conditions that they live their lives in?
According to to the Humane Society's Certified Humane Program, they can still be larger farms. They definitely need to have shelter, but there's no cages involved, and they can roam around, perch, walk around, stretch, dust bathe. They have nest boxes that actually have hay in them that they can choose to go in or not. A lot of them will also have outdoor access. There's an adequate amount of space, and the litter and hay on the floor is clean, and it's changed out regularly. So the environment is just a lot cleaner, and it's more natural for a farm situation.
You have already asked the University of Oregon to change their food policy for all their food services.
We met with Tom Driscoll, who's the food services director, and Alan Gidley, who's the assistant vice president of housing, because that falls in that department. And they took our information, and they have contacted the suppliers and tried to get pricing. They're nearly not moving as fast as we'd like them to move, but they say that they are looking into it and that they're making sure that the products that are provided by these suppliers fit our needs at this university. But dozens of other universities have made this switch. In fact, the European Union has made it illegal to have battery cages, and they're phasing them out of all their farming. So if these nations can change, other universities can change, I certainly think we can change. So if this campaign needs to continue in the fall, then I'm perfectly content to continue to do that. It just means that the longer we kind of drag our feet on this, that's more hens that are continuing to be crammed into cages because we are paying for a farmer to treat them that way.
So if people want to learn more about this issue, do you have contact information for CETA on campus, that's Students for the Ethical Treatment of Animals?
If you type in CETA as a search on the University of Oregon homepage, you'll see our website, and we have a cage-free section on there. You could also just go to eggindustry.com if you want to just see generally about how the battery cage conditions are.
People can contact Inform Radio at amy@informproductions.com.
Juneteenth may be the most important national holiday that most Americans have never heard of. KBOO's Doug Guidi has more.
Portland will be one city across the country celebrating one of the U.S.'s major milestones in ending slavery. Juneteenth. Juneteenth is the oldest known celebration commemorating the ending of slavery in the United States. Dating back to 1865, it was on June 19th that the Union soldiers, led by Major General Gordon Granger, landed at Galveston, Texas, with news that the war had ended and that the enslaved were now free. The day is honored with celebrations across the country, but is a day still unheard of by many Americans. But a resurgence of interest in Juneteenth may change all of that. Woody Bronnex is one person that wants to get out the message of the importance of Juneteenth for everybody in the United States. Woody Bronnex.
So we established a dynamic where everyone is on the same page and the communication is on the same level. Simply freedom. That is our gist. And when we look at the fact that the United States government, much as we love it, is crumbling in many aspects of the foundation, then there needs to be an establishment of another foundation. And what better foundation than the foundation of freedom as related to Juneteenth? That is still American history. And so we began to present a process of being able to work together.
But Portland's Juneteenth celebration will also focus on the history of Juneteenth in the city. The honoring of the event dates back to 1948 at the Vanport Shipyards, where Clara Peoples was able to gather fellow African-American shipyard workers for 5 minutes to honor Juneteenth. Since then, support for the celebration has wavered, only to witness a major return 10 years ago. 10 years ago, Woody Bronnex met Clara Peoples at Portland's Peninsula Park. She gave Bronnex and many a desire to see the tradition continue. One example, organizers are trying to work with city officials to see if the park's name can be changed to honor civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks. And Woody Bronnex wants to expand the importance of Juneteenth to include all nationalities and for others to view Portland as a city that honors diversity. He is encouraged by Portland's atmosphere, but would like to see more taught in Portland public schools on the importance of Juneteenth. Woody Bronnex.
What we have done is that we have negated the idea of our history for so-called American history, which deleted the contribution. And at this point, we recently, as a matter of fact, over the last couple of years, have gone to the PPS, Portland Public Schools, and asked them to teach Juneteenth history, or at that time, African-American history or African-American contributions. And there was a movement within the PPS that said that each ethnicity needed to be taught about itself. However, it was never, ever pushed.
Oregon is catching up to other cities and states with strong traditional Juneteenth celebrations. Milwaukee and Minneapolis have the largest celebrations, and since 1980, Texas has made it an official state holiday. Juneteenth Celebration 2006 is the weekend of June 16, 17, and 18th, and takes place at Portland's Peninsula Park. Music, food, gospel and blues music, along with a beauty pageant, will be present. Organizers of the Juneteenth Celebration 2006 are encouraging everyone to come out and support the event in the name of diversity. I'm Doug Guidi, KBOO News.
And now reporting for FSRN, KBOO's Julie Sabathier retells the story of Portland Mayor Tom Potter and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Last week, Potter went public with the FBI's attempt to make contact with a source inside local city hall. The FBI acknowledged that one of their agents had approached a city employee, but said the agency is not currently investigating Portland's city government. Julie Sabathier has the story.
On May 11th, an employee of the city attorney's office for Portland, Oregon, was approached by Agent Jeffrey Pritchett of the FBI. Agent Pritchett, who was loosely acquainted with the city employee, asked if she knew any city council members. He mentioned that white-collar crime and public corruption are top priorities for the FBI, and asked if she would be willing to pass on information about people who work for the city of Portland.
I was shocked.
That's Portland Mayor and former Chief of Police Tom Potter. He became aware of the incident after the unnamed city employee reported it to her boss. When he met with Special Agent Dan Nielsen of the FBI, he learned that the Bureau does not currently have an investigation open at City Hall.
There should be some mutual respect and understanding of what each other's roles are. And for me, that's not the job of the FBI to spy on local governments when they have no knowledge of any wrongdoing.
Agent Nielsen, who serves as Assistant Special Agent in charge of the Portland Division of the FBI, says Mayor Potter overreacted to the conversation that took place between his agent and the city employee.
I tried to talk to the mayor. It didn't seem like he really wanted to hear much beyond she was the FBI spying on me. That was simply not the case. It wasn't the context, it wasn't the nature, it wasn't the intent.
Portland city government has had a rocky relationship with the FBI during Mayor Potter's term in office. Last spring, with overwhelming public support, the city council voted to pull Portland police officers off the FBI-led Joint Terrorism Task Force. And Portlanders haven't forgotten that one of their own citizens, lawyer Brandon Mayfield, was wrongfully arrested in connection with the 2004 Madrid train bombings. Again, Mayor Potter.
Public corruption exists in the United States. There's just no doubt about that. And there has to be someone who investigates that. And that's probably a good role for the FBI. But when you have no knowledge and that you are not conducting any investigation into any wrongdoing on the part of the city, what is the role of the FBI then?
This comes at a time when the role of federal investigators is very much at the forefront of the national discussion. An FBI raid on Congressman William Jefferson's office was heavily criticized Tuesday during hearings before the House Judiciary Committee. And Americans are still reeling from the revelation that all of our phone records are available to the National Security Agency. Oregon ACLU Executive Director David Fidanke says the incident in Portland is part of a national trend towards more aggressive FBI tactics when it comes to investigating political groups and government employees without any evidence of criminal activity.
The Attorney General's guidelines, which were originally put in place during President Ford's administration in the mid-70s, those guidelines originally were designed to prevent this kind of fishing expedition by the FBI. Unfortunately, former Attorney General Ashcroft greatly weakened those guidelines and opened the door for these kinds of abuses on a broad scale.
At Mayor Potter's request, the FBI will conduct an internal investigation to determine whether or not Agent Pritchett acted appropriately. Agent Nielsen says he welcomes the evaluation, but he maintains that there has been no violation of policy here. For FSRN, this is Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
The family of a Washington man who died after fighting with police officers will get investigative files and other evidence, but won't be allowed to talk about it. That's because Spokane Assistant City Attorney Rocky Trepetti filed an agreed protective order that turns over all investigative files, tapes, 911 calls, and other evidence gathered to the family of 36-year-old Otto Zem and their attorneys at the Center for Justice. In exchange, both the city and the family must keep the information confidential unless both parties agree it should be released. Violation of the order could lead to contempt of court. Terry Sloyer, a Center for Justice lawyer representing Zem's family, says agreeing to sign the protective order was the only way the family would get the information. Spokane County Medical Examiner Dr. Sally Aiken ruled the manner of Zem's death was homicide. She listed the cause of death as lack of oxygen to the brain due to a heart failure while being restrained on his stomach. Toxicology tests found no illegal or prescribed drugs in his system.
President Bush will promote a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage on Monday, the eve of a scheduled Senate vote on the cause that is dear to his conservative backers. The amendment would prohibit states from recognizing same-sex marriages to become law. The proposal would need two-thirds support in the Senate and the House, and then be ratified by at least 38 state legislatures. It stands little chance of passing the 100-member Senate, where proponents are struggling to get even 50 votes. Several Republicans oppose the measure, and so far only one Democrat, Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska, says he will vote for it. The Senate Judiciary Committee approved the amendment on May 18th along party lines after a shouting match between Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, and the chairman, Senator Arlene Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania. A slim majority of Americans oppose gay marriage, according to a poll by the Pew Press Research Center for the People and the Press from March. But the poll also showed attitudes are changing. 63% opposed gay marriage in February of 2004. Tom?
Thanks, Marlise. California's governor is agreeing to send the state's National Guard to the Mexican border. The announcement came from Arnold Schwarzenegger will end a 17-day standoff with the Bush administration. The state hadn't seen eye to eye with the White House on whether California's troops would join the Border Patrol effort and who would pay for it. State officials say the governor will announce today that he'll sign a two-page document effectively promising to carry out the state's share of Bush's plan to mobilize 6,000 troops.
A Lodi, California ice cream vendor pleaded guilty yesterday to a lesser charge of trying to smuggle cash into Pakistan rather than being retried on allegations that he lied was his son's attendance at a terrorist training camp. Umar Hayat was convicted of lying to customs agents about more than and family members were trying to carry on a flight out of the country 3 years ago. In exchange, prosecutors agreed to drop charges that he lied to the FBI and to recommend he serve no more jail time after spending nearly a year in custody. Yahat's son was convicted of terrorism charges 2 weeks ago based on testimony by an Oregon informant recruited and paid by the FBI.
ExxonMobil shareholders voted for the seventh year in a row not to include lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender workers in the company's anti-discrimination policy. Rebecca Miles files this report.
The Human Rights Campaign, the U.S.'s largest lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender political organization, reports, however, record numbers of Exxon shareholders voted for the non-discrimination policy at a shareholders' meeting yesterday. This year, 34.6% of shareholders voted to add sexual orientation, an increase from 29.4% of shareholders who voted in 2005. Brad Luna from Human Rights Campaign said it's about time ExxonMobil joined the 85% of Fortune 500 companies who include sexual orientation in their policies to protect their workers. But he was encouraged by the continual growth of support among shareholders. Other major energy companies include the anti-discrimination policy, and so did Mobil Corporation before its merger with Exxon. Luna is encouraged there may be further changes ahead when Lee Raymond steps down as chairman later this year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
The former chief financial officer for the Ohio Workers' Compensation Fund will plead guilty next week to state ethics and money laundering charges. Terrence Gasper will admit to receiving $25,000 from rare coin dealer Tom No as a bribe in return for funneling investment business to No from the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation, said Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien. Gasper could face over 5 years in prison. The federal and state racketeering and money laundering charges represent the latest development in a scandal that has upended Ohio politics and led to ethics charges against Republican Governor Bob Taft. All the state officials involved in the corruption probe are Republicans who donated to George Bush's 2004 presidential campaign. No pled guilty earlier this week to illegally funneling money into the Bush campaign in 2004. The widening corruption scandal was uncovered in the wake of George Bush's 2004 electoral victory in Ohio, which led to his assuming the presidency for a second term.
Today marks the official start of the hurricane season, and the city of New Orleans does not have levees sufficient to protect it if another major storm hits. Yet hundreds of thousands of people have moved back to New Orleans, and more say that they're coming back. Christian Roseland files this report.
And we wonder, where is the outrage? Good.
Sandy Rosenthal stood in the summer heat on the banks of the 17th Street Canal this Monday, Memorial Day in New Orleans. She was there to commemorate Americans who died both in foreign wars and in Hurricane Katrina, but also to ask why the United States is not doing more to protect the citizens of New Orleans. Rosenthal is the director of levees.org, a group dedicated to holding the Army Corps of Engineers accountable for the levee failures in Hurricane Katrina.
This was a man-made disaster caused by deeply ingrained institutional problems at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the failure of Congress to adequately fund the Corps.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has spent more than $800 million repairing the levee system in New Orleans since last fall's storm. Colonel Louis Sutliff III is the commander of Task Force Guardian, the Army Corps of Engineers' plan to restore the levee system. Sutliff explains that the task of repairing the levees is enormous.
Of that 350 miles, well over half, about 169 miles of levees and flood walls were damaged. All the water control structures, 80-some percent of the pumping stations. Our strategy remains the same, which is fix this. Fix this system to what it was pre-Katrina, because we can do it. We had the money to do it before 1 June to afford a level of protection back to New Orleans that really protected the city for decades.
However, the Corps is behind schedule on some aspects of the project, and the floodgates on two canals are still under construction. And ultimately, the end goal of Task Force Guardian is merely to restore the levees to the state they were before Hurricane Katrina. Many in New Orleans, like Rosenthal of levees.org, say that goal is not good enough.
And they're doing a great job of getting the levees back up to pre-Katrina. Pre-Katrina was unacceptable.
A report issued May 22nd by the Independent Levee Investigation Team says the levees surrounding the Crescent City were improperly designed, constructed, monitored, and maintained. But beyond this, the investigation team, led by UC Berkeley Professor Raymond Seed, says the entire institutional framework behind levee construction in Louisiana, including the Army Corps of Engineers, needs drastic change.
These problems, in turn, arose largely as a result of organizational, political, and resource allocation issues intrinsic to the process as it currently exists. I myself would not purchase property and move into New Orleans if the intent of the nation and the state is to continue to do business as usual. We need to change how we do this. We cannot simply change the engineering details. If we want to make a safe levee system, we have to overhaul the process that creates it.
Yet despite the lack of protection in the event of another major storm, people continue to move back to New Orleans. Henry Irving lives in the city's lower Ninth Ward and lost his home in Hurricane Betsy in 1965 as well. He says that he is rebuilding, but he has his own evacuation plans if the neighborhood is flooded yet again. But you've been flooded twice. Are you rebuilding?
Yeah. I'm rebuilding because they don't want me to rebuild. And I'm hard-headed. I'm 70 years old and I ain't going nowhere. But I'm not even much concerned about it because I can't do nothing about it. If the hurricane come, all I can do is take my truck, pack up, and go. And I make my own hurricane plans. See, because I have extra gas tanks and all of that. So if the weather gets bad, then I'll go fill up all my gas cans, and I'll hit the road.
For Free Speech Radio News in New Orleans, this is...
And now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Okay, corporate America is shipping our manufacturing, high-tech, and professional service jobs off to low-wage Hellistan. But at least they can't send our fast food jobs away, right? After all, these require face-to-face dealings with customers, so surely they're safe. Well, not exactly. Pull into the drive-thru lane at a McDonald's, Hardee's, or Carl's Jr., and there's a chance that the friendly voice on the intercom saying, "Do you want fries with that?" is not inside the building. Unbeknownst to customers, these fast food chains are testing a new computerized system that centralizes order takers in faraway call centers. Pull up to the burger window in Mississippi or Honolulu, for example, and the voice saying, "Would you like to supersize your drink?" is likely to belong to one of 125 order takers working out of the Bronco Call Center in Santa Maria, California. They take your order from a couple of thousand miles away, then zap it back to your local burger flipper via the internet. Why? To cut labor, of course. By centralizing the process, order taking can be regimented, sped up, and closely monitored. Each call center worker, who is paid only $6.75 an hour with no benefits, takes up to 95 orders an hour, 1.5 per minute. As Bronco's big boss puts it, their job is to be fast on the mouse. Charming. Software constantly tracks the worker's speed, and even in their break room, a computer screen ticks off the number of minutes each one has been away from their station. There are a couple of pluses to the job, however. Order takers don't have to wear a uniform and one of those silly paper hats, and they don't go home smelling like hamburgers. This is Jim Hightower saying, at least these call center jobs are in America, but how long before they're shipped offshore, where an order taker can be had for a dollar or two a day? Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. here, Africa on Fire, celebrating the little-known legacy of Africans in Latin America with hosts Marianne Fry and Andrea Cano. At 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob. Weather in the Willamette Valley, rainy through tomorrow with highs around 70. In the Gorge, also rainy, but even warmer, highs in the mid-70s. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
A deadline set by African Union mediators for the two remaining rebel groups in the Darfur region to sign a peace agreement has expired. Joshua Kuelimpa reports.
The African Union Commission Chief Alpha Omar Konare is due to announce the next steps to be taken on the two Sudan rebel groups, the Justice and Equity Movement and the faction of the Sudan Liberation Army, who are refusing to sign a deal agreed to on the 5th May that would end the conflict in the Darfur region of southern Sudan. The AU has warned that the rebels refusing to sign the agreement could face sanctions and that it will urge the UN Security Council to do the same. The two rebel groups say the current deal is unjust and are asking for, among others, more political posts in the proposed transitional government. The rebels took up arms in February 2003, accusing the government of discriminating against Darfur's black Africans in favor of Arabs. The Sudanese army and the pro-government Janjaweed militia then began attacking civilians in Darfur, driving people from their homes and attacking refugee camps. Sudan denies arming the Arab militias and says the problems have been exaggerated. Joshua Charimpa, FSRN, Kampala.
Continuing our African coverage, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has asked the U.S. to facilitate the U.N. and a group of countries around Uganda to agree on a joint manhunt for Lord's Resistance Army rebel chief Joseph Kony, who is suspected to be hiding out in the Congolese Garamba National Park. Museveni says while the Ugandan army had the capacity to repel any attacks, the obstacle was Lord's Resistance Army rebels roaming free in Congo. Emmanuel Akella reports from Kampala, Uganda.
At a meeting with the United States diplomatic delegation this week, President Museveni called on the U.S. government to persuade an agreement among the DRC, Sudan, UN, and Uganda to hunt LRA leader Joseph Kony jointly. All four parties have still failed to reach agreement on how to tackle reported LRA presence in Congo. The Ugandan president went on to say that the U.S., which is heading global efforts against terrorism, should act quickly because ending the LRA terror is no longer solely a Ugandan problem, but needs the cooperation of countries Kony has fled to. The presidential spokesman, Hon. Peter Komoloit, says United States involvement is critical because of its stature on the UN Security Council.
The president has mentioned the United States specifically because it is one of the countries that are in the Security Council as permanent member. And since basically the mandate of disarming the LRA in that area of the Congo lies with the UN mission MONUC, I think the president has argued rightly that the best placed group to prevail on MONUC to do much more to disarm the LRA should be the permanent members of the Security Council. And the U.S. is the leading member in this group, is the leading funder of the United Nations.
Mr. Museveni's call comes amid rising hostilities between Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo over alleged infiltration into Congolese territory by the Ugandan army, which is ostensibly tracking LRA fighters. But the elite unit of the Congolese army, FARDC, that was sent to disarm the LRA in Garamba National Park, has instead turned against the Ugandan army, UPDF, accusing it of illegally entering into its territory. Captain John Peter Malengo, commander of the special unit sent to deal with the LRA threat, has told reporters that their enemy is Uganda. In an interview with the New Vision, a Uganda daily newspaper, Malengo said they are gathering evidence of UPDF infiltration and handing it over to the UN. The Congolese office, according to the New Vision, said Uganda was using the LRA as a pretext to invade their country. In Captain Molengo's words, they just want to enter and loot our wealth like they did in the past. LRA is not in Congo. But Ugandan army representatives dismiss the claim and say they are treating the remarks as the personal opinion of the Congolese officer. Uganda Army spokesman Major Felix Kulaije denies that his military made incursions into Congo and adds that Chief of Defense Forces General Ronda Nyakirima has just finished up successful discussions with his Congolese counterpart on a joint operation.
The captain found that the border post cannot represent state-to-state relations or military-to-military relations. The two countries are enjoying very cordial relations. The Chief of Defense Forces of Uganda was in DRC 6 days ago. He met his counterpart and held very fruitful discussions, during which they agreed on a number of joint mechanisms to deal with the rebels that are disturbing Eastern DRC, the issue of Kony phenomenon that is becoming a regional issue, since now Kony has moved into Central Africa areas, Congo is in Central Africa, having moved away from Sudan. So, what the captain was expressing are personal views which the Ugandan military leadership is going to pursue with the military command of Congo.
The U.S. ambassador here, Stephen Browning, has promised to inform his government of President Museveni's request. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela reporting from Kampala.
The U.S. military ordered commanders to hold ethics trainings today in response to increasing outrage over reports that U.S. Marines killed 24 unarmed civilians in the western Iraqi town of Haditha last year. In explaining the decision, Lieutenant General Peter Shirelli said 99.9% of roughly 150,000 U.S.-led troops in Iraq are performing magnificently daily and that they do the right thing even when no one is watching. But many Iraqis say massacres like the one in Haditha are all too common in U.S.-occupied Iraq, FSRN's Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib report.
Iraqis are outraged at reports of a massacre in Haditha, but they're hardly surprised. Almost everyone in Iraq has a similar story. Nezar al-Samarai is a lawyer from the western Iraqi city Samarra. In 2004, U.S. soldiers detained two of his nephews, ran their car over with a tank, and then threw them off a bridge to their deaths. Nezar argued the case in court, winning $2,500 in compensation for each dead nephew. One of the American soldiers was sentenced to 45 days in prison.
When we describe this kind of incident as normal because it has happened over and over in Iraq, not because it is normal or because the Iraqi people accept it, but because it has happened a lot and there's no reaction from the U.S. government to stop it. So people will say it's normal. I'm a lawyer, and I think that what they have done is a war crime, and if the Americans let the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague handle it, they will find thousands of its kind.
Indeed, Nezar al-Samarai has had his own run-ins with the U.S. military. In 2004, he was severely beaten by U.S. troops while driving his family to the hospital. On May 5th of this year, he says, he was tied up and beaten in his own home during a house-to-house raid by American forces. During the same raid, U.S. soldiers attacked a neighboring home for the disabled.
One of the houses that they raided was a house for disabled people, and the military killed three of them and injured another two. That was not because they did anything, of course. They were disabled. The other two are still in the hospital, and we do not know what will happen to them.
But at the White House, the increasing barrage of questions focuses only on the killing of 24 Iraqis, including women and children in Haditha, November 19, 2005. George Bush's spokesman, Tony Snow.
There are two tracks. Number one is what happened with reporting the incident and what happened. And the Marines are taking both of those very seriously, and they're proceeding very aggressively.
No one asked Snow about a separate series of allegations by Iraq's ambassador to the United States, Samir Soumadeh, who is accusing the Marines of killing his cousin during a house-to-house raid in Haditha last June. The ambassador says the killing was completely unprovoked and that the Marines were smiling when they left his family's home. The Pentagon says they investigated the matter and there was no unlawful killing. It's difficult to independently verify such reports because most human rights groups have left the country, citing security concerns. Nada Doumani is spokesperson for the International Red Cross Iraq, which is now based in Amman, Jordan.
And sometimes we've been very much constrained and limited in our movements in Iraq. So we don't move everywhere in Iraq. Unfortunately, we're not present everywhere. And therefore, we cannot comment on events that are happening in all areas in Iraq.
Still, the number of disturbing allegations is staggering. Nezar al-Samarai's cousin, Sheikh Ahmed Yahir al-Samarai, is an important tribal leader in western Iraq. It was his sons who were thrown off a bridge to their deaths in 2004.
What happened in Haditha was just one example. If the Americans make a real investigation and are honest, they'll find thousands like it. It's an everyday incident.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam.
An Army private was acquitted today of charges that he abused inmates at a U.S. detention facility in Afghanistan. Private First Class Damian Corsetti was the last soldier charged in the Army's investigations of prisoner abuse in Afghanistan. He cried with relief when the court-martial panel cleared him of charges of assault, maltreatment, dereliction of duty, using hashish, and drinking on duty. The panel deliberated about 30 minutes. Corsetti was accused of mistreating detainees at an American jail at Bagram Air Force Base in 2002 and 2003. Army prosecutors said he hit, kicked, sat on, and threatened to sexually assault the men. Corsetti is the last of 15 soldiers to face charges in an abuse investigation launched after two detainees died in 2002.
Hundreds of Shiite Muslims, enraged by a TV comedy that mocked the leader of Hezbollah, took to the streets of southern Beirut today, burning car tires and blocking roads, including the highway to Lebanon's international airport, police and witnesses said. The trouble began shortly after a TV show on Lebanese Broadcasting Corporation, a privately owned Christian channel, in which an actor spoofed Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah wearing the Hezbollah leader's trademark black turban and sported a similar beard and spectacles. Hundreds of Hezbollah supporters immediately went out into the streets of southern Beirut, the stronghold of Hezbollah. The two remaining rebel groups in Sudan's Darfur region that have so far refused to sign up to a peace agreement have once again rejected the deal. The African Union has been trying to persuade the Justice and Equality Movement and a faction of the Sudan Liberation Army to sign the deal by yesterday, almost a month after the initial deadline. Only the main faction of the Sudan Liberation Army has so far signed the AU-brokered deal with the Sudanese government. At least 200,000 people have died during the conflict, which began in 2003.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 1st, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producers for tonight's newscast are Lisa Loving and Josh Johnson. Tonight's audio editors are Jessica Rink Perry and Josh Johnson. Our wire editors are Emma Finn and G.D. West. Special thanks to reporters Jessica Rink Perry and Doug Guidi. Our engineer is Josh Johnson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Levin. And I'm Tom Knipe.
And I'm Marlise Franklin. Hey, stay tuned for Independent Native News. Coming up tomorrow morning, bright and early at 7 o'clock, hear the KBOO Morning News. And at 7:30, hear Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, it's APA Compass, featuring a visit to the campus of Portland Community College to discuss women of color in independent media, and a live discussion about Asian and Pacific Islander GLBTQI perspectives. And as usual, the Angry Asian Minute. At 10, the guest is Leslie Larson, whose first novel, Slipstream, is an ominous L.A. saga featuring the stories of several characters whose lives eventually collide. 10:30, it's Sounds of Awareness with Paul Van Dyke. That is all right here on your KBOO station. We're nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored. That's you. We're your community radio station. Thank you. Oh, one more thing. Are you a newsaholic? The KBOO News is looking for people who love to think, write, and investigate. Have free time during the day? Find out more. Call Lisa Loving at 503-231-8032, extension 203. It's great fun. Come join us. This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 1st of June. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The president of South Dakota's Oglala Sioux tribe is facing impeachment after promising to build an abortion clinic on the Pine Ridge Reservation. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Charles Michael Ray reports, tribal council members say she acted without their approval.
President Cecilia Firethunder proposed a reservation abortion clinic after the South Dakota legislature passed a ban on nearly all abortions. But this week, the tribal council passed an ordinance barring abortions. The council also suspended Fire Thunder for 20 days until an impeachment hearing can be set. Anita Ekafi is a tribal member leading the charge against Fire Thunder.
We've never wanted a clinic of that like that here on the reservation. We've always believed, and I believe that we'll continue to believe that the children are sacred.
President Fire Thunder has stated that she intends to use private funding to construct a women's health care facility on her own land. She calls the effort to oust her an ambush. Fire Thunder has already survived two prior impeachment attempts on separate issues. Charles Michael Ray, Rapid City, South Dakota.
An initiative being proposed for the November ballot would clear the way for a new casino to be built near the Iowa-Nebraska border. As Pat Blank reports, the casino would be jointly owned by three Nebraska tribes.
The proposal comes from the Santee Sioux, Omaha, and Winnebago tribe members, who've seen their counterparts in Iowa raking in millions of dollars the past 10 years. Chair of the Omaha tribe, Eleanor Baxter, says the goal is tribal economic development and services.
With the job market, there are no jobs. We do have programs from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which allows us money to put in to employ some people, but our rate is probably 60% to 70% unemployment.
Nebraska does not have legalized gambling, but federal law permits tribes in many states to run their own casinos. If the facility is built, a consultant says 70% of the profits would be split among the three tribes. That could be as much as $20 to $40 million a year for each. The other 30% would be distributed to nonprofit entities, including schools and municipal governments. If supporters of the project can collect enough signatures by July 7th, the proposal will be on the Nebraska state ballot for the general election in November. Reporting from Cedar Falls, Iowa, this is Pat Blank.
Scammon Bay, Alaska, a Yupik village on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, hosted a festival over Memorial Day weekend to honor several local men deploying to Iraq this summer. From KNOM in Nome, Amy Flaherty has the story.
The festival featured three nights of fiddling music by groups from surrounding villages. Maddie Simon helped organize the event because her 19-year-old son is part of the 2nd Scout Battalion, 297th Infantry, going overseas. She wanted to do something special before he left.
Leave with a strong mind, knowing that he has support. And also the men, too. I wanted the whole community to get together so they'll know that they have a lot of support from the community. I didn't want them just to leave without us doing anything for them.
The community also held religious services to inspire the National Guard members and lift up their families. John Rivers Sr. traveled from the village of Quinnahawk to lead the services. In Yupik language, he asks the soldiers to make Jesus their commander in charge as they go into harm's way. The Stebbins fiddlers donated their time to fly over and play some two-steppin' tunes. Band leader and guitarist Francis Pete says the deployment hits close to home.
You know, being here, it's a really privilege, and I find out that these troops are my cousins too. Donating our time, it's like, you know, giving to the family, you know, try to raise up their spirits and not worry too much.
Specialist David Tanutmak says the number of soldiers deploying from YK Delta villages is growing since the last surge in the 1980s. He'll leave his expectant wife and several children to serve in Iraq. Tanutmak says they'll go to base training in Mississippi this summer and begin acclimating to unfamiliar, desert-like temperatures. In Nome, Alaska, I'm Amy Flaherty.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.